The future is on the line. Democracy hangs in the balance. The stakes couldn't be higher.
It's Thursday, May 21st, 2026. You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with Scott Baba. On today's show, we'll do a California statewide ballot rundown with voter specialist and political analyst Paul Mitchell from Political Data Inc. Later, we'll hear from the legal strategist behind Hawaii and Montana's Citizens United legislation. All that and more. Primary midterm elections are underway in the U.S., and California voters have less than 2 weeks until they head to the polls on June 2nd. You're listening to The Stakes. I'm Teresa Wersbianska with Scott Baba.
A new poll by the New York Times and Siena College finds Democrats are heading into the 2026 midterms with a political advantage over Republicans, but also facing deep frustrations within their own party. The survey found Democratic candidates leading Republicans by 10 points among registered voters, even as more than half of Democratic and Democratic-leaning voters said they are dissatisfied with the party's direction. Many respondents said Democrats have failed to effectively counter President Donald Trump, while others call for major changes to the country's political and economic systems.
President Donald Trump scored some major victories in Republican primaries on Tuesday, with one of the most significant coming out of Kentucky. But first, in the Georgia Senate race, Republican Congressman Mike Collins and former football coach Derek Dooley will head to a runoff. The two competed against Congressman Buddy Carter, who was a top contender in the race but didn't make the runoff after coming in third place. The race, which was expected to go to a runoff, largely came down to who would be the strongest general election challenger to Democratic Senator John Ossoff. In Alabama, Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville is set to face former Democratic Senator Doug Jones in this fall's gubernatorial election. Tuberville entered the race as the clear Republican frontrunner and has been a strong supporter of President Trump. Jones, who served in the Senate from 2018 to 2021, defeated several Democratic challengers to secure his nomination. Alabama voters also cast ballots Tuesday in primaries for U.S. Senate and congressional seats in anticipation of the general election. Oregon, Pennsylvania, and Idaho also had primary elections this week, but all eyes are on Kentucky and that state's District 4 congressional primary race. In that race, Representative Thomas Massie was defeated by a Trump-backed challenger, Ed Gallrein, after the president and his allies poured tens of millions of dollars into a sustained advertising campaign targeting him.
President Trump is banning sex changes on minors. Massie voted against it. President Trump is cutting taxes and saving Kentucky families $10,000. Massie voted against it. President Trump is securing our border and deporting criminal aliens.
Massie has frequently defied President Trump during his time in Congress. He opposed U.S. military strikes against Iran, calling them unconstitutional, and also co-authored the Epstein Files Transparency Act with Democratic Representative Ro Khanna of California. Trump-backed candidate Ed Gallrein won with nearly 55% of the vote. The American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC, and other pro-Israel groups also spent over $9 million in an effort to defeat Massie. Here is Massie in his concession speech Tuesday night.
We're tired of meddling overseas. We can't afford it. Our empire will collapse if we keep sending our money to other countries. I never picked a fight with the country that's tried to take me out here. Because I've never voted for foreign aid to any country. We got to take care of America first. America first.
Representative Ro Khanna suggested Tuesday that Massie's defeat may have been linked to his efforts to pressure the Trump administration over its handling of the investigation into convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein and Trump's possible connections to that case. Again, here is Representative Massey from his concession speech on Tuesday night.
And we need basic decency. We need basic decency. That's what the Epstein Files Transparency Act was all about. By the way, today is the six-month anniversary of the Epstein Files Transparency Act. We've taken out 24 CEOs, an ambassador, a prince, a prime minister, a minister of culture. And that was just 6 months. I got 7 months left in Congress.
Over the weekend, thousands of people gathered in Montgomery, Alabama for the All Roads Lead to the South rally in response to the Supreme Court's Louisiana versus Calais decision, which organizers say weakened protections in the Voting Rights Act and opened the door to new rounds of partisan redistricting. The event, organized by a coalition of civic groups, brought together activists, elected officials, and community members at the Alabama State Capitol, the same grounds tied to the 1965 Selma to Montgomery voting rights marches. Here is Democratic Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York at that event.
And our home country must understand that it was not until voting rights were ratified in this country that we got the Great Society. Because when Black Americans have the right to vote and that vote is protected, our schools get funded. When voting rights are protected, healthcare gets expanded. When voting rights are protected, our country moves forward. In Montgomery, that's what they're actually afraid of. They're afraid of us coming together. They're afraid of us protecting one another. Alabama is the crucible. Georgia is the crucible. Tennessee, Louisiana, Mississippi is the crucible. So if you are not from here, it is time to pull up. Because what they thought was the final blow is actually just the opening silo.
In Los Angeles, public safety, homelessness, and a growing budget crisis took center stage as LA mayoral candidates squared off in a heated debate. In the run-up to the primary, Mayor Karen Bass defended her record on reducing homelessness and lowering crime, while challengers accused City Hall of overspending on police contracts as basic city services deteriorate. Joan Walsh reports.
The three leading mayoral candidates facing off in a debate tackling the issues of police budget, public safety, and spending. Bass said that during her tenure, homelessness fell by 17.5%. With the rise of encampments being a public safety concern, Bass said she had been working on hiring more police officers, but the city council had been pushing back on that. Candidate Rahman, the city council member, countered that the proposed contract gave the police union more money than the city had, leading to the city's billion-dollar budget deficit last year that led to cuts to essential services across the entire city.
If you're wondering why your streetlights are out on your block and the Bureau of Street Lighting is telling you that it's taking a year to fix a streetlight, that's council why. Member-
Bass and Rahman both talked about a decrease in crime, but candidate Spencer Pratt countered that that didn't mean the city was safe.
I talk to thousands of moms a week. They do not feel safe in the street. No matter what these crime statistics are telling anybody, it's not how people feel on the street. There's a difference between people reporting crime and feeling unsafe on the street. And with Councilwoman Rahman, people are more concerned about getting stabbed on the street than the lights being out.
For homelessness, Mayor Bass referred to her city program, Inside Safe, a housing-led strategy to bring people inside from tents and encampments, and to prevent encampments from returning.
Inside Safe is the only citywide program that we have had that has reduced homelessness 2 years in a row. Prior to that, there was no citywide strategy, and homelessness was going up year after year.
Pratt and Rahman said the program was too expensive and not effective. Pratt accused both Bass and Rahman of failing in handling the homeless crisis, as they were both working together as a team during the last term. Rahman accused both Pratt and Bass of attacking her because they wanted to run against each other in the general election because her ideas were based on real results and analysis of the system focusing on accountability. Pratt responded,
Mayor Bass and I are definitely not working together. I blame this person
for burning my house and my parents' house and my town and all my neighbors down. I am not working with Mayor Bass. Second off, if I wanted to run against anybody, it would be the council member who is terrible. Mayor Bass has at least been a mayor for almost 4 years. You think it's easier to run against the incumbent mayor or a random city council member who's been a failure for 6 years?
Emerson College polling results show Bass leaning at 30%, Pratt in second at 22%, and Rahman close behind at 19%. While the race is nonpartisan, Bass and Rahman are Democrat and Pratt Republican. The Los Angeles mayoral election will be held on June 2nd. If no candidate receives a majority of the vote, a runoff election will be held on November 3rd. Reporting for KPFA News, I'm Joan Walsh.
You're listening to The Stakes, KPFA's new election coverage show. I'm Scott Baba here with Teresa Wears-Bionska.
As many California voters receive their ballots and begin to fill them out, voting expert and political analyst Paul Mitchell joins us now to talk about what voters need to consider as they mail in their votes or head to the polls. Mitchell is a nationally recognized political analyst and redistricting expert with decades of experience studying California and national elections. As vice president of Political Data, Inc., he specializes in voter behavior, demographic trends, and campaign strategy. Thanks for joining the show, Paul.
Thanks for having me.
The primary election in California is coming up on our heels on Tuesday, June 2nd, and lots of us are now looking at our ballots for the first time. For voters just opening their ballots, what are the major statewide offices being decided in California, and why are those races so important?
Well, the first thing they see when they open their ballot is going to be like 60 names of people running for a governor. It's like the whole page. And that is the most pivotal election on the ballot for most people right now. There are some competitive congressional races. There's obviously the LA mayor's race. Some people might feel like that's more immediately important in their lives. But the governor's race is kind of what we call the top of the ticket. And then there are other statewide offices. We call them constitutional offices, things like superintendent of public instruction, lieutenant governor, attorney general, state treasurer. You know, those offices, some of them have incumbents in them. Some of them are open seats. Many of the names that you see there are kind of familiar because you see some people kind of switching offices, like the state treasurer and lieutenant governor front runners are the lieutenant governor and the state treasurer switching offices. And then beyond that, you have in LA, obviously, the mayor's race. You have local congressional races with, you know, under Prop 50, the lines are new. So even though a lot of the big changes in the redistricting from Prop 50 were, you know, in other parts of the state, you will find that many Angelenos realize that they're in a different congressional district. And so that's going to be interesting, obviously. And then beyond that, legislative races, some local city council races, but most city councils have their elections in November. And so the magnitude of all the local elections will probably be on the ballots in November.
California's ballot includes, as you said, contests for governor, lieutenant governor, attorney general, and other constitutional offices, as you just said. Which of these races are likely to have the biggest impact on issues like housing, climate, immigration, criminal justice, and, of course, ICE?
Absolutely, it's the governor's race. Well, let's put it twofold. Statewide, it's the governor's race. There are some congressional districts in the state, particularly in the Central Valley, and then one that's kind of like Palm Springs down to inland San Diego County, the 48th Congressional District, where some of those races might help determine who controls Congress, whether Democrats take back Congress or not. So for voters in those particular districts, the congressional race might actually be most important in a lot of those key issues because they're kind of voting on control of Congress. The governor's race beyond, you know, is much more important than a lot of the other constitutional offices in terms of those issues. And, you're seeing the candidates talk a lot about those issues, but then also you're seeing this prominence in the election of, you know, the top two primary and the implications of the top two and trying to make sure that two Republicans don't make the runoff if you're a Democrat, or if you're a Republican trying to make sure two Democrats don't make the runoff. That is the other thing that is becoming more prominent in how people are thinking about voting in this election.
And that was going to be my next question. California uses a top two primary system for many offices, but including governor. Yes. Can you explain how that works and what voters should know about how candidates advance to the general election?
Yeah. So when we're voting historically, before 2010, you know, Democrats would vote for their Democrat nominee and Republicans would vote for their Republican nominee. And then the nominees would go and be in the general election. So you always had a Democrat, a Republican, a Green Party member, a American Independent or Peace and Freedom candidate, a Libertarian. And that was who's in the general, like the top vote getter from each party. We got rid of that system and went to what's called a top two open primary, where all the candidates are listed. So you've got these 61 candidates for governor on your ballot. And the top two vote getters are the ones that go to the general election. Historically, it's a Democrat and Republican. It just mathematically works out that way. But in this election cycle, there's been a lot of focus on this concern that with two prominent Republicans and like eight Democrats all splitting up the vote, you could see the two Republicans making the runoff. And the flip argument is that if two Democrats were to get maybe above 20%, you might find a situation where neither of those two Republicans make the runoff and it's two Democrats. And I will also tell you that if you're a Green Party candidate voter or a Peace and Freedom voter or a Libertarian voter, those candidates have no chance of making the runoff because none of them are, you know, tickling more than a percentage point. And so they're not going to be on the ballot in November in this open, this two party or this top two system. So it has become a key concern of voters. We've done polling where a lot of voters have expressed, you know, I wanted Chad Bianco, but I voted for Steve Hilton because I want to make sure Republican makes the runoff. And on the flip side, you've seen Democrats say, well, I wanted to vote for this kind of heart pick of mine, this candidate I really love, but I ended up compromising and voting for this other candidate because I want to make sure that Democrats get a candidate into the runoff. So it has been, in a way, distorting people's voting decisions.
Proposition 50 temporarily allows the California legislature to use new congressional district maps beginning with this election, replacing the maps drawn by the state's independent redistricting commission. Can you explain how this new redistricting map will impact this midterm election?
Well, it will impact this midterm election on a national scale by pushing back on what Texas did. They drew five districts to flip them from Democrat to Republican. And so California voters said, OK, we'll match that. We'll draw five districts to go from being Republican to Democrat. Obviously, this is on paper that they are Democrat Republican districts. We will have to have the elections, but they're districts drawn to favor these political parties. This was completely foreign to many Californians. We haven't seen a partisan redistricting in decades. It was foreign to me. I've never drawn a partisan redistricting in my career. All my redistricting's been nonpartisan for commissions and for local agencies. So this is a new temporary system. If you're living in like the Southeast cities, you'll find there's another new congressional district in your area. We also saw in like the San Fernando Valley, some movement in those congressional districts, and other parts of this, of the, city in Los Angeles, there's just no changes because it was hard to, you know, use voters in say Santa Monica to try to make a district in Bakersfield to be more Democratic. So, it was a little bit limited, the impact it has in Los Angeles, but you know, there are some voters who will find themselves in a slightly different district.
In addition to candidate races this election, what statewide propositions or ballot measures should voters pay particular attention to? And what are any key debates surrounding those?
So statewide, there aren't any statewide ballot measures on the ballot. The turnout in primaries, particularly gubernatorial primaries, is so low. You know, the last gubernatorial primary, only a third of voters cast ballots. And so that means that the electorate is traditionally a lot older, more conservative, more white, more Republican. And the legislature basically decided that citizen drafted ballot measures can't be on primary elections anymore, in part because the primary electorate is so non-representative of the total population that it was better to have ballot measures that are created by the public on the November ballot. The legislature can still put ballot measures on the primary. So we've seen them in 2024. There was Prop 1, which is the governor's housing and homelessness ballot measure that was on the primary ballot, but a lot fewer things on the primary ballot. Now, locally, you might find that there's a local bond measure or some other local issue on the primary ballot, but there are no statewide ballot measures. And I'm not really as informed on all the local ballot measures.
When you step back and look at the entire statewide ballot, what do you think are the biggest stakes for California voters this election? And what should our listeners focus on as they decide to vote?
Well, I think the biggest stake in this election is our relationship with Washington, D.C. and what's happening nationally. And it is odd. I mean, I kind of wish that we could be focused on a lot more of those mundane statewide issues, but there's a cloud hanging over the state. Whether you're thinking about issues of housing, there's, you know, the federal government standing right there, homelessness. When you're talking about the ICE, when you're talking about abortion care, abortion access, we know access to mifepristone, access to abortion nationally can impact California. We passed a different Proposition 1 to guarantee in the Constitution right to abortion access, but that doesn't stop the federal government from doing things to restrict abortion access in the state, even though we have a constitutional amendment here. Full disclosure, my wife is the CEO of Planned Parenthood, so this is something that I hear a lot about in my own household. And so those are really kind of the most critical things. There are local issues, obviously. There are statewide issues. There are things that we need to make sure that folks are electing competent leaders who can help us navigate the challenges of things like the emergence of AI, which is basically being born here and regulated nowhere. And trying to figure out solutions to housing and homelessness and even local issues in individual communities. There's a lot of need to focus on those, but kind of the most paramount thing on the ballot this election cycle might be a governor that's going to push back on the Trump administration. And it might be the votes in those key congressional districts to see if there's a change in the control of the House.
And as we wrap up our conversation, is there anything, Paul Mitchell, I haven't asked you that you think our listeners need to know about this upcoming election?
Well, the one thing I'd really urge is if you or a family member live more than 50 miles from the urban core, so if you're listening to this and you live somewhere out in the Antelope Valley or you live out in Ventura County somewhere and you're not nearby kind of a city center like Norwalk, where the LA County Registrar's Office is, mail in your ballot early. The postmarking of a ballot is what makes your ballot valid. If your ballot is postmarked by Election Day, then it will count. But the federal government has changed policy, and no longer are voters in, say, Ojai getting their ballot postmarked at the post office in Ojai. It is actually being sent to maybe LA County, maybe somewhere else, another city, to actually get the postmark. And that might take days. And so as a result, we saw in 2025 that there was a fourfold increase in ballots being disqualified because they were too late from rural areas. So we saw this impact in real time in 2025. And there's not a lot of focus right now on this importance of mailing in the ballot. The U.S. Post Office is saying a week early. And if you can't mail it in a week early, taking it to a local drop box or taking it to a vote center, which are open 11 days out from the election. So that's the one thing I keep wanting to impress upon people is don't sit around and wait for the perfect moment to return your ballot. Fill it out, mail it today.
Thanks so much for coming on The Stakes, Paul.
Of course. Thanks. Great seeing you again.
That was the voice of voting expert and political analyst Paul Mitchell. Paul is the vice president of Political Data, Inc.
You're listening to The Stakes on KPFA. I'm Teresa Wersbianska, here with Scott Baba.
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders and Democratic Representative Summer Lee introduced new legislation yesterday aimed at eliminating super PACs by limiting donations to the political committees. Here's Sanders.
The Abolish Super PACs Act would limit individual super PAC contributions to $5,000. Billionaires would not be able to pour huge amounts of money into super PACs. And it would end the era of unlimited spending and put power back into the hands of the people.
The move comes after Hawaii's Democratic Governor Josh Green last week signed into law a first-of-its-kind measure aimed at curbing the influence of corporations and anonymous dark money groups in that state's elections. It tests a legal strategy designed to sidestep the Supreme Court's landmark Citizens United ruling that unleashed unlimited political spending by outside groups. Since the Citizens United ruling, campaign spending has exploded in scope. In the 2024 federal election, the campaign finance watchdog group Open Secrets tracked more than $4 billion in outside political spending. That's almost 12 times as much money as in 2008, the last federal election held before the Citizens United ruling. I spoke with Tom Moore, senior fellow at the Center for American Progress, which crafted the legal strategy the law is based upon. All right, so just a bit of background for my listeners. Could you give me a brief outline of the Citizens United ruling and how it changed our legal system?
In 2010, the Supreme Court decided that corporations that had the power to spend in politics could not be restricted in their ability to spend independently in politics. This led to the world we have with all this dark money and super PACs, and has led to an explosion in dissatisfaction and unhappiness in our political system.
And so you guys helped design and propose a bill in Hawaii that would sort of sidestep that ruling. So how does that design to work around it?
Yeah, so it turns out that the plaintiff corporation in Citizens United was a corporation that had been given all the power to do anything that a human could do by the state of Virginia. And you look at the laws and you look at the history and all this, and the reality is that corporations get all their powers by the states. They're created by the states. You know, if they want to have the power to spend any money on anything, if they want to have the power to spend, own property or sign contracts, that is a power that the state has given to them. And before the state had a corporation section in this law, there weren't any corporations. You know, they do not exist out in the world by themselves. So the bill in Hawaii basically just says, all right, you know what? We get to set our powers however we want for the corporations right in Hawaii, and we're going to take that list of powers that you've been using for a long time, and we're going to take them back for a sec and hit a shorter list of powers. Shorter list of powers doesn't include power to spend in politics.
So have you seen any kind of pushback when you were trying to pass these laws?
Absolutely. Nobody likes to have money taken out of their pocket. And this is a major change for all kinds of entities, for progressive nonprofits that adapted after Citizens United, for conservative nonprofits that adapted, for unions that adapted. It was the world that everybody was living in, and they had to make the best of it, and they did. And this would largely kind of almost restore the world that existed before the Citizens United decision and have everybody do what they did back then. And that's how they would raise their money. So instead of writing a check out of your main checking account, if you're an organization, you have to raise money through a political action committee, through a PAC. That's what everybody did before Citizens United. That's what they'll do after this Act 11 is in place in Hawaii. And at the end of the day, you know, every dollar in Hawaii's politics will be from an individual. It'll be disclosed, and that is a tremendously better system that Hawaii has seen for the last 16 years.
In terms of sort of a legal pushback, what kind of arguments have your opponents been making in trying to fight this bill?
They've been kind of disappointingly surface, actually. Basically, they wave Citizens United at this as if it were some kind of magic wand, and it's not. You know, the court in Citizens United said that if you've got the power to spend in politics, you've got the right to spend in politics as a corporation. But it has never said, not in Citizens United, nor in any case ever, that states have to give them the power in the first place. And powers and rights are just not the same thing. You cannot mash them up. No court ever has. I think a lot of people who know election law but not any kind of corporation law think that this is just an easy fix and this is just playing word games. It absolutely is not. These are fundamentally, foundationally different things, powers and rights. I have a way of explaining it that has helped me understand the difference between the two and helped some other folks. And I'll ask you this. Do you have the power to fly? I mean, flap your arms and fly.
Well, you know, as a child, I thought I might, but probably not, no.
Not for great distances or you know, high altitudes.
From the garage to the ground.
Do that. It's not flying. It's what? Falling with style, right? But humans do not have that power. We don't have that capacity. Our creators did not give us that power when they created us. Birds, bats, pterodactyls, they have that power. We don't. So if the Supreme Court came to you and said, hey, good news, you have a constitutional right to fly, would you go to the roof and give it a shot?
Not today, no.
No, nor any day, because it doesn't change the reality that you don't have the power to fly. They can say whatever they want about your right to fly, but it doesn't have any bearing on whether you can fly or not. It doesn't change that underlying reality. And it's the same for corporations. Hawaii has now said, we're not regulating our corporations. We are redefining them. And they are now defined basically as, you know, entities that can't fly, entities that can't spend in politics. And if a court says like, no, they've got a right to do that, it doesn't change the underlying reality that artificial persons, you know, all kinds of corporations, nonprofits, everything that's not a human in Hawaii no longer is defined as having the capacity to spend in politics. And courts don't really have a lot of tools to deal with that.
Given the current climate with the Trump administration and the current Supreme Court that do not appear to strongly respect prior precedent and established law, do you have any concerns that those currently in power might say that they can fly regardless of all evidence to the contrary?
This is not a regulation kind of thing. This is the state creating corporations, defining them, giving their powers. It's a whole different authority that the state is using. There's no clean way to undo this. There's no easy, no court can just say, you've given powers A, B, and C. We think you should give them power D. You must now give them power D. Courts can't do that. That's not part of their authority. If there's a regulation they don't like, you know, you had regulations A, B, C, and D, and they don't like D because it violates the Constitution in some way, they can say, okay, you can't enforce D anymore. Fine, that's what we see all the time. This kind of law is entirely different. You know, courts have erasers, not pencils. They cannot write another power into the law here. So this does not rely on a Roberts court that has any kind of scruples at all. It doesn't rely on, it won't touch the White House at all. It won't touch Congress at all. The way I've been thinking about it is there's no way that the Roberts Supreme Court, the current Supreme Court, is going to enjoy this. They're not going to like it when they see it. It's kind of like, you know, asking them to uphold it is kind of asking them to eat a spider. And I'm never going to convince them that they're going to like eating the spider. But I can convince them to eat the spider if the alternative is drinking a glass of battery acid. And all of they basically have to dismantle foundational corporation law to get at this. It would go against a bunch of things that they want, that they like federalism and the stability of American corporations and all kinds of things like that. Places where courts don't go, not because they're being good judges or, you know, there's any kind of scruples that they're upholding. They don't like, you know, the Roberts Court does not want to disrupt the American economy. And they would risk that if they overturn this. So I think they will eat the spider. I'm never going to convince them it's, you know, a chocolate chip cookie, but I don't have to. I just have to convince them that they don't want to drink the glass of battery acid.
So now you're in Montana trying to get this kind of legislation repeated there. How is that work going? And with your success in Hawaii, Do you see Montana as a possible stepping stone, as a path to scaling this up to more states beyond just Hawaii and, I guess, now Montana?
Yeah, so actually, it's actually the reverse. They've been working on this in Montana for a year and a half. It's a ballot issue. It's going to go straight to the voters instead of going through the legislature. That just takes a lot more time. You have to get the language vetted through the attorney general and all these different things. And so it was the folks in Hawaii saw what was happening in Montana and said, oh, we should try that. That's where the interest came from in Hawaii. And the folks in Montana they're well on their way to getting the signatures they need. They need 30,000 signatures. The deadline is June 19. And they're going to be absolutely able to get those signatures. And if it gets on the ballot, it will pass. And something really exciting this past weekend, Pete Buttigieg came to Butte and packed a 1,200 person theater and spoke very warmly about this, endorsed it, made a point that this is something that could really change the rest of the country. And it has really fired a lot of people up here in Montana. And I think that will have the effect of encouraging other states to do it. But what it'll really do, whether it's Hawaii or Montana or both, is kick off a giant lawsuit where people are going to say, hey, this violates Citizens United and corporate interests who don't like having less than they had 10 minutes ago are going to complain bitterly and so forth. And that's where the action is going to be. And I think the day that the Supreme Court says, sorry, guys, we got to eat the spider on this one, that's when in the 48 other states, every state legislator in those states gets 500 phone calls from their constituents saying, like, you got to do this today because we hate dark and corporate money in our politics.
So are you working on getting this legislation on the books in any other states yet?
Yeah, so it was introduced in 15 state legislatures this year. Hawaii was the only one that it survived in. It's still moving in North Carolina, but that is probably not going to pass there. We expected that, totally. The first year for any kind of legislation is usually, the best way to get it passed this year is to have it fail last year and the year before. Usually takes two or three cycles to get things moving. Hawaii was a tremendous surprise, very pleasant surprise. I think the reason there's a difference there is one of the big reasons was the sponsor of it, Senator Carl Rhodes, highly respected. It was his last year. This is like the last thing that he does in the Senate is getting this passed. And people didn't want to stand in the way of that. They respected him a great deal. This was something that is the kind of good government thing he'd been trying to do for 20 years, and nobody wanted to get in the way. And at a certain point, even the people who did want to get in the way, it became kind of a speeding freight train that nobody wanted to stand in front of. So everybody hoped the next person would kill it, and then nobody did.
What's your next step moving forward?
I am getting the legal case together. Filling that glass with battery acid, getting all the different ways together that to demonstrate to a court that it does not want to overturn this. That's the big thing, preparing for the court cases. There'll be a whole bunch of bills introduced in the legislatures next spring. That's usually when legislative sessions get going. So I'll be, providing any assistance I can then. Right now we're looking to court defenses.
What kind of world do you hope to see when this kind of stuff all passes with dark money out of politics? Like, what do you hope to see sort of as a result of all of this?
What this will bring is a system that people tried to build back in the 70s after Watergate, where all the money is from people, all the money is disclosed. And voluntary. I see a world where if you are a Republican or a Democrat who wants to actually get something done in your elective office, work across the aisle with folks to actually get the votes that you need to get something passed, that you don't need to fear dark challenger being funded who's lost because you dared to actually try to get something done. That is a problem on the left and on the right. And it would be a better country if legislators don't have to operate that kind of fear. I see political cycles where we don't have the corrosive political communications funded by absolutely unaccountable groups. If there's an ad out there horrible about somebody, you'll be able to see who paid for it, and you'll be able to go to that person and say, I'm going to hold you accountable for this. that is a very different world than we have. It's a better world, and I think it's going to increase people's faith that democracy is a good thing, and their voice matters, and their vote matters, and that they have some control over all of this, because they do.
All right, Tom. Well, thank you so much for talking to us.
No, it's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And that was Tom Moore, Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress, which crafted the legal strategy behind Hawaii's new law curbing dark money in elections.
And that's it for the show. The Stakes airs Thursdays at 10 a.m. Check for information about topics and guests online at kpfa.org. For comments and ideas, connect with us at news@kpfa.org. Big thanks to the team, Lauren Schmidt, Jose Gonzalez, Scott Baba. Our engineer is Kirsten Thomas. I'm your host, Teresa Wersbianska. See you next week on The Stakes.